Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, Eric Beiler. You're listening to Coffee Party Radio. I hope a number of you will call in today because we have some great guests. The number is 646-929-2495. Our first guest is Wasim Entabbe. He's a friend from Virginia. I met him back in 2006. He is an immigrant from Syria, and he's going to tell us as much as he can tell us about his involvement in the Arab Spring by remote. We also have with us Andres Ucheche. I met Andres in 2008, and he is a filmmaker and a singer-songwriter, and we collaborated in the past on videos uniting Asian Americans and Latinos on the immigration issue. And later in the program, we're going to have Erica Andiola, one of the hosts of the show, call in. We will also have the filmmakers behind the new Sheriff Joe Arpaio movie calling in the second hour. But first, I'm just going to say hello to our co-host, Jose Gutierrez. Are you there, Jose?
Hey, Eric. Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm sorry I was not so smooth on the fading in and out of music.
Sorry.
I understand you had a trip recently. Where'd you go?
Yeah, I went to Mexico, a city called Cuernavaca, Morelos. It's in the state of Morelos. It's about an hour south of Mexico City. And I went to pick up my grandparents because they got their visas. it's my grandfather's. He's been here a couple times ever since the Bracero program in the 40s. And But it's my grandmother's first time coming here. So it was really a big deal for her and for her family. And it was pretty exciting to have her come to the States after. She hasn't seen some of her family here for about, I would say about 20, 22 years.
Oh, my gosh. That must have been a lot of tears.
Yeah. we filled up the pool with tears there. But it was good. It was really heartfelt and really an emotional time for everyone. So it was enjoyable.
All right, great. Well, I want to ask you more about your interaction with fellow members of the Coffee Party, with the blogging that you've been doing and that I've been doing on the immigration issue. I think we're expanding some horizons, and that's what we're doing tonight on our show. So let me bring in our first guest, Wasim Entabbe. Wasim, how are you doing?
Hello. Thank you for having me, Eric.
Oh, it's so great
to
talk
fine.
To you. That's good. How's Virginia? I miss Virginia.
Oh, man. Virginia is hot, hot, hot. You know, President Obama already been here quite a few times. He's been going up and down. And they want to make sure that his Virginia will vote for him, and I think they will.
Yeah, I think Virginia might be an Obama state again this year. Yeah, I agree. So I'm interested in what's going on in another country, your home country. But first, tell us about your journey here, how you came to be an American citizen.
Oh, boy. In the early 80s, I started as a student in this country, got a one-way ticket to the United States, was direction not to come back for my dad because he knew there's no reason, there's no future back home. And he said to me, this is a great land, this is America, go there and just make it for yourself and make it happen. And this is where I started and went to school, slowly built myself up and fell in love with a beautiful redhead lady and married to her. And we have two wonderful kids and I've been an entrepreneur all my life working for myself and I have built a nice empire for myself. So.
An empire.
I'll say that.
What kind of an entrepreneur are you, Wasim?
I am into anything that will help people, anything that will make their life better. from being at one time had a toy operation where it was a purely educational product that has helped children to learn and be able to be productive and be better citizens, and moved on to working with the Obama campaign for a while and knowing that I can make a difference. And as now I just shifted the gear and went into green energy, reselling product for green energy, so we can convince consumers to switch from regular coal energy for same or cheaper price to a green energy. And there's a very few places you can do that. States Meld is one of them, and Ohio and D.C. So that's where my target market, and we've been very successful on that. And plus, we every single consumer, we're taking that the carbon footprint down tremendously. So
the last time I spoke to you, you shared with me a lot about your involvement in what's happening in your home country and in other countries in the Middle East. How much of that can you share on the radio here? Could you give us an overview?
Yeah, I mean, everything right now, it is very clear. This is what's going on there. Let's wind back a little bit back to the Arab Springs. That was started by this brave man who was so frustrated and did not see the future, and he decided to burn himself. And it literally lit up a whole revolution, the whole Middle East and Arab countries, was just simply sacrificing himself. And then, you know, Tunisia started with few days, managed to really make it happen. And suddenly their ruler pressure moved out of the country. And suddenly now, you know, they're doing better and moved to Egypt the same way. And luckily, Mubarak had like a nerve of decency for him to step aside also and manage to give liberty to the people there. And it is like progress. They're still working on that. Moved to Libya, and we all know what happened there. Gaddafi would not step aside, and he was murdering people right and left, and he ended up pretty ugly way. And I was pretty much involved in every single one of them because I knew I was able to make a difference some way, somehow. If nothing, just organization or phone banking or be able to structure medical assistance. Whatever it was, I was in it just to make sure that I can help. And was very successful because the Arab community themselves is really, I mean, they are fresh generation in this country. And they're not savvy about organizational structuring, organizing crowds, getting things done in that manner. With me working with a lot of political campaign, I had that expertise and managed to do a lot of organizational structure and help them achieve very good goals. Now, we moved to Syria, where this is something I personally never predicted that will happen, because knowing Assad, I thought that everybody would be so scared to death from this guy. They would never step up, never. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people are tired from oppression, tired from no freedom, and no liberty, you know, right to determination not exist there. So they just decided to just open their chest and take the bullet, and they're willing to do it just because they don't see the future anymore. It started very, very peaceful. Everybody did not want to shoot a single bullet. They want to just go out and demonstrate. And sadly enough, the Assad regime had a big opportunity then to really react and respond to the people. But he made the wrong choice, and he decided to shoot back. And that have not stopped from then. It's been getting worse and worse and worse. To the point is right now we over 50,000 people dead, over 200,000 people missing, thousands and thousands of women were raped and children were molested. Horrible stories, horrible stories. And you know, right now my journey with them is just simply help him cope. A system, especially with medical and media assistance, and give him a little direction on how to organize food lines or money lines, so this way they can assist each other. And this is what's pure. It is purely humanitarian assistance to them because it's going out of control right now down there.
Mm-hmm. You know, one more question before I bring in Jose and Andres. There are some people who, you know, are concerned about immigration or angry about immigration. It's funny they never bring up the fact that immigrants are, I think it's 30 or 40% more likely to become entrepreneurs, as you have, Wasim. But one of the things that they do talk about is how people who are born in another country still have an interest in the politics and in the fates and fortunes of the people back home. And I wonder if you could speak to that and, you know, tell us about how you feel about this country and if there is a divided loyalty for you being both Syrian and American.
This is this pretty tough, actually, because sometimes you feel like you can't be relating to any of the countries anymore because you are yourself, you become your own world. But in the end, you still have your heart in both places. I love this country. I think this is where my kids are going to grow up, and this is where my kids is going to continue their life. This is where I'm probably going to end up dying and being buried. Mm-hmm. I will give this country anything I can. But at the same time, I still feel for the people there. They are, part of me also. And I would love to give them what I have in here, or possibly the ideal or philosophy, how we operate, how we work, how we achieve things. They could do it. They can do it if you give them the opportunity. But there is no opportunity right now, and hopefully one day will come. Right now, in this country, I am to tell you, with my interaction with all those entrepreneurs, literally the success rate on the people who I connect with, and of course I connect with a significant number of immigrants myself, they are, they weren't born in this country, and they come in here, appreciate everything that this country gives them. They do work very hard. They do everything they can. And amazingly, they make something out of nothing. And they really make it happen. And they really help this country go forward. They really do.
Yeah. So in the second half of our show, we'll be talking about what's going on in Arizona. Of course, the United States Department of Justice has filed a civil rights lawsuit against the infamous reality TV character and also elected sheriff of Maricopa County, Joe Arpaio. We're going to be talking to Dan DeVino, who directed he's done a number of immigration films. His latest one is just coming out now. It's called Two Americans, and it tells the story of a young Arizonan child alongside, intercut with the story of Sheriff Joe and his struggle to hold on to power and to quiet dissent in the county government, in the press, and among the citizenry during his reign of, I guess you could call it, terror. Okay, so I'm going to bring in Jose and Andres. First, Jose, I just wanted to see, did you have any comment or any question on what Wasim has been talking about so far?
Hey, Eric. Yeah, you know what? I was kind of nodding my head the whole time because I was thinking, you know what? I think Wasim and my family could really relate to each other because when I went to Mexico this past couple of days, the same story that I kept hearing over and over was, go to America, you're going to get a better life out of it. You're going to really make something out of going to America and making a life for yourself and your family. For example, my uncle, he runs a catering business. And he was saying how, he served dinner for 1,000 people. It was a big feast, and he got paid a whole, $150 for the whole thing. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? Yes, come to America. Yes. You can run the whole show there. So, it's just incredible because you keep hearing stories about how, life in America really is, you you can achieve the American dream because there's so much more opportunity, so much more economic prosperity among the immigrants who come here, among the entrepreneurs, just like my dad, just like Maxine, and they really make something out of it. And I think that just really speaks to it. And I first of all, I congratulate him on making an empire for himself. I think that's great. And keep it up. I mean, you're really an inspiration to a lot of the other immigrants coming to this country. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to bring in Andres Useche now. Andres is a few days away from a very important day. So, Andres, can you tell us about what's going to happen on May 16th?
Well, finally after – hello, everybody. Finally after, I guess, getting very involved in trying to get more civic participation and people involved in the – I guess the destiny of this country. I'm going to be proudly becoming a U.S. citizen and finally casting my own vote, which is a lot of fun.
Awesome.
And very important for me after, you know, trying to get people to vote for so long.
That's great. It sounds like Wasim wanted to say something about that.
Oh, that's congratulations. This is a beautiful thing. So I tell you, there's nothing like that feeling. I remember
Thank
that
you.
Feeling.
Thank you. Very related.
Yeah, that is amazing. So, Andres, tell us about your home country is Colombia.
Yeah.
Tell us about your decision to come here and your journey.
Okay. I feel a little, you know, privileged just because I had a chance to start coming to the States since I was a child because my dad came to study in San Francisco and I fell in love with San Francisco and with this country back then. And being an artist, I was always sort of in love with, you know, comic books and jazz blues and rock and all these beautiful American art forms. And little by little, I guess, I started learning about the principles this country was founded on. And one of the things that I loved the most in every visit was just, it seemed like a window into the world. It seemed like this was a place where many, many cultures were represented. And each had their own voice, and I could learn and share with my brothers and sisters from around the world here. And so I just fell in love with this country. And I knew I wanted to get back, you know, as soon as I could. And then during my college years, which I did in Colombia, which was just way more affordable for me at the time, I made a little film which sort of got things going and got a couple of awards and a little bit of notice and just enough for a couple of producers here to want to talk to me and see it. And that's how it started, actually. They got somebody, you know, I was supposed to work on this big project, and they the Directors Guild wrote a letter on my behalf saying, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that sort of started the legal process back then. And then ever since, I don't know what happened. I just got very, very involved in politics and learning about history and thinking about equality. And then, you know, you and I crossed paths, Eric, and started working on that. And it's just, you know, it's a life-changing experience for me. And after that, I did, I started doing some stuff related to the environment, you know, trying to bring awareness to different factors, doing some PSAs and little films and shorts with some great people I've always admired, and then eventually came back to the, I guess, the activist, you know, part of it when SB 1070 happened, and I was just appalled by that discrimination and you know, there was the usual suspects behind it, you know, the Koch brothers and Alec and all of that, and it seemed like it was reminiscent of too many things that I didn't like, and it just felt completely unfair, and it just touched a nerve, because through the process of being here, even though I had been sort of blessed in the way that I came into this country, I am very aware that many people just don't have that same chance, and some people just out of desperation, you know, they have to find a way to get here, and I know how much this economy depends on their hard labor, you know. So I felt very connected to the community that being grown to be a part of, and decided to go and march and create that song, March Into the Light, and became very involved with that process. But was very happy to find out that the administration thought it wasn't constitutional for them to take it upon themselves to change immigration law, and that they wanted to sue the state, which they did, and later Joe Arpaio for misusing his authority.
Mm-hmm.
And then connected with so many dreamers. So that brings us up to the present and just what I've been doing with dreamers and working on their behalf, because they responded very strongly and they got to meet so many along the way, and have just been working and wrote that song, Dream to Belong, for them, and have been getting very involved in that as much as I can.
Well, we're going to do a coffee party radio first. We're going to play Dream to Belong in a little bit.
Okay.
This is the first time we've had an artist and a song, other than a little opening music on our rinky-dink, but very proud 99% media radio station here. So I just want to see if Wasim or Jose have anything that they wanted to say in response to Andres's introduction, and then we'll go to the phones. I see a 281 area code waiting, so get ready with your question or comment, 281 area code. But Wasim or Jose, did you have anything you wanted to ask or comment on what Andres just shared?
I just want to say that I've heard a sneak peek of the song, and I think it's awesome. And Andres, you're really talented, so I can't wait for everyone else to hear it, because I think you really are, like, creative. It's funny how music can really create an emotional bond for a lot of people going through the same ordeal, and I think you really capture that. And, I think you did a great job. So thank you.
Thank you.
You know, that's not fair that you guys had the sneak preview. I never heard the song, so that's okay.
But you will.
So I would look forward to listen to the song. I'm sure it's good because it comes from the heart, probably.
Definitely.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, well, let's go to 281 area code. You're on Coffee Party Radio. What's your name? Where are you calling from? What's on your mind?
Yeah, this is Egberto Woodies, and this must be a call of immigrants because... that's what we have anyway. Good show that I'm listening to, and it's great hearing from Jose and meeting all the newcomers on the show. I'm an immigrant myself, and maybe one particular question is, do all of you guys feel that you're now a part of the American dream, or do you allow yourself to feel less than when among those that really like to wrap themselves in the flag as if they are, let's say, the real Americans?
Okay. Can I jump in?
Go ahead.
All right, thank you. Well, you know, I can say something, being in here since the 80s. We've been fighting that Islamophobia from the day one I came in here myself. I'm Arab and I'm Muslim. And, you know, it have not stopped. And it have not stopped to the point of ridiculous. You know, until today, our country teach Islamic hate of phobia in Pentagon and for the FBI. I never felt that I was threatened by, because I always held my head high and really felt that it's my responsibility to educate the Americans about who we are and what we stand for and what Muslims are all about, and nonstop. And I named my children with Arabic names. It happened that this to be a Muslim. I taught them not to be embarrassed from that, because this is their heritage and their background, and to hold their head high and continue to educate other people about the other cultures. And I also was my job to teach my kids other cultures too, this way they will know how to be together and work together and live forever happy after. So the flags is not something I will wrap myself around, although I'm very proud of it. I, you know, at any time I see it, I respect it, and I will actually fight for it if I have to.
Okay, if I may say something, this is Andres. And I think it's key to not just leave prejudice alone, but to get in there and try to educate people, because I think that's where it comes from, an irrational fear and just ignorance of other cultures. And me coming from Colombia, in Colombia there are many people who feel, you know, the United States has had economic policies that are very destructive, you know, to some other countries in South America. You know, the record of U.S. foreign policy in South America hasn't always been the best. You know, there's been a lot of wars and a lot of things also. But there's something that I've always reacted against, even when I wasn't on the process of becoming a U.S. citizen, and it was that when people generalize and they say, you know, just fuera gringos, you know, like, it's a stance against all people from the U.S., and that is just blind prejudice. And I've known, and I had the fortune of coming here before and having met, obviously, so many activists from here and so many, even from, you know, leaders from the standpoint of civic leaders and politicians, know that one has to educate oneself and others about the differences, you know, and just like I try to do in Colombia, speaking about, you know, all the cool people here who are either progressive or just very tolerant, or I guess that's not the right word, tolerant, but just very embracing of diversity, that we do that here, you know, with people that just don't know enough about us, you know, those that come from outside or I guess everyone has come from somewhere except from the Native Americans, but yeah, I think that's the key, just getting to and trying to reach people. And I personally try to do that with music, because I know that creates a very strong bond with people, as somebody mentioned, and Jose, I think, so yeah, I mean, in the end, we're all human, and it's just all this BS that gets stuck in between, and that we have to, and we can fight against, you know, we have to keep the struggle going.
Yeah, I guess inevitably, when we have immigration as a subject, and we have people who are immigrants conversing, we will get to that question of how can we, and how should we respond when people choose as a topic for the angry circus that they participate in hatred of immigrants or hatred of Muslims and Arabs, hatred of Latinos? We had a lot of conversation on the Coffee Party Facebook page over the last few days about whether all of the sentiment that we see is anti-immigrant, anti-illegal immigrant, or simply anti-Hispanic. What has really been gripping our country, and what seems, you know, it's nice to have you on the phone, because I often say that this whole anti-Latino, anti-Hispanic problem, I think began as the popularity of President Bush's war on terror began to wane, that simply the characters changed in the soap opera that we all call the news, but the tactic was basically the same, right? There's this other kind of people, they're not like us, they're not really American, they can't be trusted, we must institutionalize our fears into
laws. Yes, yeah, you know, that fear-mongering, yes, absolutely, absolutely, and it worked very well for him. They created a wedge and made people really start to be scared and uncomfortable because of, you know, their intolerance type of beliefs and not willing to accept the other as one of them. Yes, absolutely, I agree with you. And sadly enough, that is, he turned the whole Republican Party into this ugly machine and into the hate mongering, and have not stopped. I mean, really, it got worse and worse to the point that we went into that other party that is, I don't even know when I actually mentioned their names, but yes, and I mean, you know, you see the whole discussion, really, if you remember, Eric, it literally started in our neighborhood. And this was a bonding between the Muslims and the Latino community in Herndon at one time, where we felt that is things need to be a change because we had all our brothers standing for labor in the rain and cold. And, you know, we noticed them because we got to prayer early in the morning in the mosque. And, you know, driving into that neighborhood, going to the Adams Center, we used to see them standing in the rain and the snow. And when we start to talk about it, say, we cannot let those brothers stand like this. This is not fair. And this is where it started. And sadly enough, from being good things, the hate mongering party decided to turn it on us as well as on the Latino brothers and created a serious, serious problem for us. And the stretch become a nationwide discussion. You know, that Labor Day was a great thing, and it really made a difference for in their life for a few months. So,
Go ahead.
Yeah, there is a fear for the change, the social structure that of the country. I mean, I think also, you know, I mean, you look at me, I'm a black Latino, and you look at all the other people that the country is changing. And because, in as much as we supposedly are an integrated country, I don't think people grasp yet, you know, and specifically, I'm talking about the majority population. It is an understandable fear that I usually tell. Suppose these others treat us like we had normally treated them. And I think under a lot of what we see, that is the fear that's out there. The fear that somehow it's no longer our time, and will they treat us the way we treated them? So I think it, in a lot of ways, one, we need to, this is a personal opinion, but I think we need to keep our heads up high. I think when we're up there talking, we are not supposed to let anybody believe we're less Americans. After all, everybody came here to take this land over for an opportunity, and by God, any one of my folks from any part of the world that want to come over here to take this land as an opportunity because it's been done already, so be it. So we should keep our heads raised high. But secondly, I think we also should be empathetic. You know, when I say empathetic, and this really goes towards mostly white men, because this seems to be the most fearful group out there. And I've spoken to a lot of, you know, I speak frank to my folks out here. And I've spoken frankly to several of these guys. And you can see that inherently that is the problem. White men fear what, you know, when the power structure is not that anybody's trying to take over the power structure. It's just that the power structure now is going to be sheared and losing that omnipotence. These guys don't yet know how to handle it. So when I talk about being empathetic, to let folks know, hey, we're coming. Change is going to happen, but you shouldn't be fearful because we're not going to do to you what you did to us.
You know, Jose, Egberto, that reminded me of something that my dad said to me. Now, my dad is Caucasian.
Right.
And he's a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was, you know, he sort of raised me to be a Republican, but then I went to college and I started to learn about things like history and, you know, economics. But when I was in my early 20s, I was talking to him about this, and he said something that always stuck with me. He said, "Do you expect us to just yield?"
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it's just not human nature to yield power if you have it.
Exactly.
And so we have the Citizens United decision. And so we have the Tea Party narrative. And so we have these voter suppression laws and the, you know, the ALEC corporate agenda in order to try to hold on to power. And it used to puzzle me, what was the natural link between this sort of fear of losing white racial prestige and the corporatocracy? Like, why would that naturally be linked? Because I don't think there's any a priori reason why the two interests would be aligned, other than when you are in the 1% and you have access to these tremendously powerful media resources, the very same ones that turned the fear harvesting messages in some ways from the Arab and Muslim community and toward the Latino community around, I'd say, 2005, 2006. When you have that power to essentially decide for millions of loyal consumers who to be fearful of and why to be angry, when you have people who essentially abdicate their own capacity for free thought in exchange for your entertainment programming, if those are the only people really that you can count on to help you pursue that 1% agenda. And that's where the link comes. The link is actually through mainstream media.
You kind of tickled my fancy here. When your old man said, "Do you expect to yield?" What question was he responding to?
Well, I think I was talking about, you know, equal rights. I don't remember the specific issue, but it seemed to me that a lot of the cultural struggles that we were having in the 90s had to do with preserving white racial prestige. Mm-hmm. And so what he's saying is yes, that we have that now. And yes, the writing is on the wall that is going to change, but it's just not within human nature to say, oh, okay, well, other people want equality, other people want opportunity, other people, you know, would like to remove institutionalized racism from our laws, but why should we just agree to that when the status quo is to our advantage?
Now, did you recognize, let's say, and the reason I'm asking it in this question is like, let me see how to ask this of the host. How would he look at you being biracial? Did he look at you as a biracial person or his white son?
Gosh, I don't know. I could just tell you around that same time I asked him if he wanted me to marry someone who was white.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Why do you ask that?" And I said, "Well, if I marry someone who's white, then my children will be 3/4 white, and you'll have white grandchildren. And if I marry someone who's Asian, then your grandchildren will be 3/4 Asian. And can you imagine what your dad or his dad would have thought that the Byler heir is three-quarters Asian, because I am his only son?"
Right.
And he said, "You know, son, if I was worried about that kind of thing, I wouldn't have married your mother."
Cool. Good answer.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that unfortunately he's been bombarded with a lot of that soap opera news that causes us to focus on our differences rather than where we have common cause as Americans.
Exactly.
So I think he understands that by marrying an Asian American woman that if he didn't know it at the time, he knows now that I'm just gonna be a different creature because I'm part of the community of color. So I'll just leave it at that. Let's see if let's see if did we lose Andres? I don't see him on the board.
He came back on a 310, I believe.
Oh, he did? Is that okay? Well, let me go to 310 and see who is this.
Hello, it's me. I'm back.
Oh, you came back on 310?
Yes, it's me.
Okay. So
I'm a little behind because I got disconnected, but I did have something to say earlier. So I don't know if somebody's gone over this, but I was going to say.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say we're going to play your song, so maybe you could make a comment and then introduce the song for us.
Okay, great. I was just going to say that I feel there's a lot of, and somebody mentioned the power structure, and I think that basically, you know, there are certain interests that want to maintain inequality, economic inequality, and sometimes we just want to pit us against each other. You know, many folks in the working class and the middle classes, and divide us by gay, straight, you know, Hispanic, white, whatever, what have you. And instead of us saying, okay, you know, we are the majority, and economically we're being oppressed by 1%, or the greedy ones in the 1%, because not everybody's like that, who is pushing against us. But I think they'd rather have a debate on the basis of fear. So it's pretty crazy, because it's like solving inequality with inequality. I mean, that's their base. It's a different kind of inequality. And but I think we ourselves are the antidote, and progress and basically time and the future is on our side. Historically, that's where we're moving. We're becoming more accepting, and I think that's why we should strive for each other's rights, and not only be involved in racial equality, but marriage equality, and basically stand up for anybody that's being oppressed or that's being treated unequally. Because interestingly enough, I believe in a way, you know, this country was built by pilgrims and immigrants, and it's still us that believe in the American dream, you know, and the philosophical aspect of equality, justice, and just having that sense of that we can pursue happiness and not be discriminated against. So it's up to us to keep the struggle and remind people that it's not just about, you know, making the most money, but something deeper and more important than that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing just before we go to the song that occurred to me that I probably should have said before is that I now understand why there's a link politically between the 1% and people who are especially anxious about demographic shift and really hung up on the kinds of divisions that plagued us in the 20th century. But what I don't understand is how these consumers of 1% media come to perceive that by pursuing the agenda of the 1%, they are somehow preserving their own power, because really they aren't. They have to subscribe to this hyper-partisan framework where if Republicans win, then white men win. And I can understand why they perceive it that way. But really, in terms of their quality of life and the opportunity they have to provide for their families, these policies do nothing to help them with that. And so it's only this mirage of maintaining that white racial prestige that Republican electoral victories have been, you know, presented to them to be. But really, if you break it down, I'd rather have a fair opportunity to get a job that would allow me to provide for my family. But anyway.
Right.
So Andres, the song.
Okay.
What was the inspiration? Where were you when you wrote it?
Okay, so after Marching Into the Light Marching Into the Light was dedicated to these dreamers who just had an accident in California, but it had, you know, the main topic was just immigration reform in general, and that was the main theme. So I was a little bit taken aback and surprised by the response that I got from dreamers, and I got to meet many of them and get very involved in the fight, and I always wanted to write a song about them. And I was here in Houston, where I am right now, at my brother's house. And there's a piano here because my stepmom is a great musician, and she has a piano. And I just started playing on this old piano. It's a little out of tune. Mm-hmm. We inherited it. And it just came out so – actually, the verses came out really quickly, like right away. And I struggled a little with the chorus because I wanted to get it just right. But then after that, Joaquin Luna committed suicide, and that touched me profoundly. And that sort of gave me the force and the more, even a greater drive to finish the song and get it out. And I dedicated it to his family, and they loved it. And I'm actually working on telling this story a little bit more after that. But that's pretty much the story of the song so far. And, you know, dreamers have heard it here and there, and we're sort of filming, and we'll have a video out pretty soon, I hope.
Andres, tell us about Joaquin Luna.
Joaquin Luna was a young man who was an extraordinary student. His engineering teacher thought he had the greatest future, but he felt that he had no chance of succeeding, that he had the world against him. He couldn't tell the differences in government and who was fighting for who. He just felt this country doesn't want me, and everything that I've dreamed of I will never get. And that was his whole mission in life. He wanted to be an engineer, and he actually he had designed the house that his family still lives in, you know, when he was a kid in school. I mean, he was an amazing talent, and sadly. He committed suicide, and he left many notes behind that I know about, and I've talked a lot extensively with his family, and it's very clear that that was what was causing him to be so depressed. You know, he might have had a biological something that went undetected before, but his family says that he never showed any signs of depression. It was just this sort of was very heavy on his soul, and he took his own life. So it's a terribly sad story, and I'm part of the song, and you hear it in the chorus. It tries to be an upbeat song because I don't want to leave people hopeless or sad. I want to sort of inspire, and I wrote it in a way that I'm trying to reach out to many dreamers who might not know that we're all in the fight, but there's so many people behind them, that there's people in the government, there's Durbin, Obama is calling for immigration reform, the Morton memo came out. I worked and personally with dreamers that were in the queue to be deported, And because of the Morton memo, you know, all those cases are being dropped basically because of prosecutorial discretion, through which I can just, you know, the people, they've been asked by the administration only to deport dangerous criminals and avoid deporting hardworking families and dreamers. So there's all this thing going on, and we haven't gotten there. That's just temporary. We have to get rights, you know, a path to citizenship in the Dream Act, and get the Dream Act passed. But it's happening. It's just so what I'm telling dreamers is just hold on and let's keep going, and we're going to get this done. And that's what the song is about.
Okay, here is "Dream to Belong" by Andres Useche. It's 4.5-minute song, and I'm going to ask Wasim to be the first person to respond to the song since he did not get the sneak preview. Here it is.
Town. He may be from way down south, but she was brought here as a child, and he grew up in this house. They learned while in school of a light many had seen, getting the tired and the poor, yearning to be free. Be gonna fly, beacon of hope, keep shining bright, ignite the dreams of us all. Every one deserves to learn, every child deserves to dream, when they only want to serve, when they want to just give. We dream to be raided her home and could deport her before long. She had learned while in school about a torch many had seen, guiding the tired and the poor, yearning to be free. A beacon of light, beacon of hope, keep shining bright, unite the dreams of us all. Everyone deserves to learn, every child deserves to dream, when they only want to serve, and they want a chance to give. Buscar un
I'm sorry that it doesn't sound as good as FM radio, Andres.
No worries. Thank you for playing it.
This is amazing. You know, this is really hit home with me. You know, talking, especially right now with this revolution in Syria, it's just, when ICE go into a house and hit people's homes and try to arrest our brothers in this country, I tell you, it's almost identical to what the SS are doing also back in Syria, the way they attack homes and do horrible stuff inside those homes without any respect to dignity of the people there. So, but, you know, I will go back again and I will say that it is a journey. I mean, this is, I don't suspect it's going to be that easy, and this, for all of us, it's going to be a long journey. And it does not matter what, we have to stay positive. We have to teach our children how to stay positive, and we have to be very engaged with everything we can. We have with all different communities, and unite each other, be together in one hand. If we can join hand and just do it together, I think we'll succeed. We'll become the majority minority as we speak right now. We don't have to wait one day for one of us to become a majority. We can be together, and we end up one unit. So,
yeah, there's not going to be any majority. Let me see if Jose or Egberto want to respond to the song.
Yeah, actually, it's a beautiful song. It brought me back to my good old college days, you know, sitting down in a pub and having a nice odules and just kind of meditate into the music. I mean, I love the style.
Yeah, I love the chorus.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
And I love when
agree. I think that was great.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jose.
No, I was just going to say that I think the song was great, and I think it really captures, like, the sentiment of what these streamers are going through. So I think you really captured it in the song.
For our non-Spanish speakers, Andres, could you tell us what the Spanish language part of the song says?
Yeah, it says, yo no dejo de buscar, and I will never stop searching, por una luz, una señal, for a light, for a sign, give us the chance, danos la oportunidad de hacer el sueño realidad, of making the dream come true. It's pretty much the same message, it's just in Spanish.
I love when you do that.
That's my favorite part of your Obama song.
Really?
Yeah.
And in Marching Into the Light, I did the same thing. It's mostly, the reason I write most of the song is in English, because it's coming from trying to represent us also, but to the community at large, and trying to convey our message to all the other ethnicities. So, but I keep a little bit, you know, to reference in Spanish to remind us where we're coming from, at least from myself. Hello?
Oh, I'm here. I was just coughing, so I put myself on mute for a second. So, how are we going to change the conversation about immigration from one of culture war and grievances and resentment and being punitive and even hateful, with the perception that there's a power struggle and that elections are one way that they're expressed, and also legislation that essentially expresses power by appropriating law enforcement to focus on immigration status instead of public safety. All of that puts us at a disadvantage, and it also very cleverly distracts from the real issues, where the anti-immigrant agenda is at a disadvantage. For instance, the economic impact of abandoning our brand, the best thing about the American brand, right? Nation of Immigrants. It's that's how we're known around the world, and that's why the best and brightest have always come here. That's how we became the greatest country in the world. If we left it all up to the pilgrims and the Native Americans who weren't, you know, slaughtered, and that's it, we wouldn't have become the greatest country in the world. We became the greatest country in the world because of the people who were brought here originally to be slave laborers, because of the Chinese immigrants who replaced that labor force when they were emancipated, because of Latino immigrants who came and replaced that labor force when the Chinese were by law excluded from immigration. These immigrants built this country, Irish, Italian, Russian immigrants. So we abandon that. We're gonna have a hard time competing in the 21st century. But unfortunately, when we talk about immigration, we're always talking about what this person did to me and how I have to punish them, and is, you know, legal, is illegal, and all that stuff. How are we going to change the conversation?
If I may go first, I just wanted to say, and usually in interviews, sometimes on TV or whatever, sometimes they tell me, but you're such an optimist. You know, it's like almost as not being realistic at all. But I am an optimist, and I think that you have to be the change you seek, and you have to, like, basically, we know very clearly that we are on the right side of this issue. I mean, morally, it's a moral, we have a very solid moral ground, even though, you know, people may laugh at it, but we have history behind us, you know, as you said, everything that you just said, Eric, about the role that immigrants have played in building this country. And we also have on our side that you know, just the way that the population is moving, we are going to be more and more represented as time goes on. At the same time, we may seem overwhelmed sometimes, but since we know we're in the right, that gives us so much passion. You know, we can make any argument, any appeal to the human heart, to reason, to morality, why everyone should be considered equal, and it's in the founding document. And that were written and set down by people who were, you know, who were descendants or were brought here from Europe. So that's basically the concept of this country, and we embody it today. We believe in it, and fortunately we have many allies. And sometimes even when it seems like the whole world is against us, or we, you know, we have media, we have Fox News peddling hate, and we have all of this, it also has to energize us to come out and do every single thing that we can, every single day that we can, with all our hearts, because it's not just for us, but for the future of our children and for this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Siim, what do you think?
I fully agree. you know, the positive messages have to be there. As I went, go back to what I said before, the engagement is, this is something that I discovered that is the Muslim community and our Arab community did not do much of for a very, very long time. And this had to happen because of 9/11. It was not a choice we made. Somebody hijacked everything we believe in and they used it and hurt people. And suddenly we become the victims, and we needed to educate people that we're not that believe in philosophy. So we engage with everybody, and we just building our structure to actually teach people who we are and what we're all about. And this is a process that is, I can say that every single community came to this country had to go through. But sadly enough, in the 21st century, I didn't think we should, but it is still look like it's the same type of recipe. We have to go through it, and I welcome it because it will help me learn more about myself and about my community. And I also learn about others as I'm doing that engagement. And it's working for us, and I think this is the Hispanic community need to get involved that way too. I can relate to them so much because I think we operate almost, we have same philosophy and mentality, and I can say that is the what make us different is almost identical what make us alike 100%. So we can work again going back together. We think it's the same journey, and is we mm-hmm. should stand all together all the time.
Jose, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, so we know that the problem is that immigration in general is just a problem. And when we sent out the last newsletter, I got a couple of responses, and one of the ones that I got I thought was pretty interesting because basically he pointed out the fact that everyone knows that the system is broken, and nobody wants illegal immigration. Illegals don't want to be illegal because, you know, it's detrimental to their quality of life. You know, they're getting taken advantage of within the workplace. And so there's been so much bickering between the left and the right and just different political power struggles of how we're going to fix this immigration issue. But no one's actually, like, going down and saying, okay, well, what is it about illegal immigration or what is it about immigration that's broken? And I think one of the stories from a guy named Nick, he said that he came in from Australia. He married a U.S. citizen, and after filling out like a whole list of forms and being told that he was okay to come, and he came, and then was all of a sudden told that his paperwork was lost and that he had to leave the country within 14 days. And this was after like the third or fourth trip, and it was just like this big mess of like just sloppy, just it's not organized and it's not working. And when Republicans or any of these political leaders are saying, oh, well, why don't they just get to the end of the line? Well, the issue is that there is like no like physical line. And for example, like my grandmother, she's been waiting 20 something years just to get her residence visa. And I think that's where it has to come to is like everyone knows that immigration is an issue and the immigration system is broken, and it's just we have to buckle down and really concentrate on how we're going to streamline it so that it works and it works for everyone, and there's a solid process that you follow when you're trying to apply for a visa or a residency or citizenship, and that way, you know, there's no reason for immigrants to come illegally if there is a legal path. I mean, and that's another thing. Like, I don't know if you guys saw the recent article. Can't remember why I saw that, but the net immigration to the United States is at zero, like for the first time in decades, because the amount of people who are leaving or being deported is equivalent to the amount of people actually coming to the United States. So, I mean, I don't know why there's still an argument about, oh, illegals are taking our jobs and all this nonsense when that's not the case. I mean, we're at zero immigration right now. So
yeah.
Really the conversation should be how are we going to fix this immigration system and not oh, are you legal because you're here at the age of four and it wasn't your choice? And, you know, that's just ridiculous. And I think we should really just be concentrating on how we're going to fix the actual immigration system and help people come here legally.
Yeah. Well, I have an answer for that. I mean, the question is, you know, the obvious question based on what you just said is, if immigration is at a net zero, and it's, you know, the number of people crossing the border at, you know, 10, 15, 20-year lows, why are we still talking about this? Why is it such a big issue? Why is it basically a litmus test for the presidential nominee to come from the Republican Party? And I think that just has to do with politics. In fact, it has something to do with melodrama. It's like, well, why is it that in the soap operas, everybody always sleeps with their sister's husband? Well, it's just, it's good drama. You know, it keeps the people tuning in and it helps you sell the commercials. And I really think that this issue is being exploited by electioneers, by strategists, political strategists, because at the end of the day, all they really want is power. They want to be in power so they can exploit that power to enrich themselves. But they don't really care how they get there. And I think that this issue right now is being used just as the September 11th attacks were exploited politically and you know, as Wasim can attest, dramatically impacted the Arab and Muslim community in this country. But that is just a collateral damage when you're basically playing politics like it's a script from a melodrama. Well, with that, I want to bring in Erica Andiola. Erica is a dreamer. She is from Mesa, Arizona. She is one of the hosts of our new Coffee Party immigration show. And Erica, I don't know if you were aware, but we have with us on the show Andres Useche, who wrote a couple of beautiful songs about the dreamers. And we played one of his songs earlier. And he actually is going to become a United States citizen in less than a week. So I can't wait to hear the two of you guys meet each other. So Andres and Erica, say hello to each other.
Hello.
It's great meeting you. I'm really, really excited to be back. And, I mean, thank you so much for the support that you're showing to the Dreamers as well.
Thank you. It is a privilege.
So what's going on in Mesa right now, Erica?
Well, Arizona is always it's always on the news. I mean, basically, right now we're dealing with the whole situation of still with Sheriff Arpaio. I don't know if you talked about it before, but we had the DOJ, the Department of Justice, do an actual announcement of they're suing the Maricopa Sheriff's Office. So, I mean, it's really, for us, it's great news. I mean, we've been pushing for this for a while, and it's been many, many years that this has been happening in our community, as we have been targeted for so long, and at least, you know, we're getting some attention now. So I think a lot of people over here are really, really, I mean, they're excited that at least this is starting to happen, and we hopefully see some results, and we can hopefully have, you know, Arpaio be kicked out, and even, you know, he deserves even more than that, be treated the same way that he has been treating us. So it's been a good week so far, but we're still pushing for him to be out of office.
You know, this is actually only the second time that the United States Department of Justice has sued a law enforcement agency for racial profiling. The first time was in New Jersey, and there was a long history of people of color being pulled over and being harassed. And federal government sued, they successfully sued, and won the case, and as a result, the department went through a process of basically, well, they improved their approach, and instead of looking at law enforcement as a way to protect one race while victimizing another race, They said, well, what if we try to keep the entire community safe and we try to build a trusting, cooperative relationship with all elements of the community rather than choosing sides? And, you know, in the case of politicians and showmen like Arpaio, he chooses sides with mm-hmm. the people who already have the power. And then he just says, well, the people who don't have power, I can just deal with them in some other way. And so I can't imagine how infuriating it must be as a taxpayer in that county to know that your taxpayer dollars go toward a sheriff's department that, instead of doing public safety, expends its resources on this immigration hysteria and electioneering and showmanship. Literally, the guy was a reality TV star and a sheriff at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can understand why there would be a lot of anger to begin with, and then some sense of, I guess, relief or redemption that the United States government, our Justice Department, is actually seeking justice.
Yeah, and definitely. I mean, like I said, this has been happening for a really long time. So, I mean, I am really, really positive that they have a lot of evidence of what he has been doing. And I'm hoping that, you know, that same history that has happened with the other lawsuit, that could definitely happen here. And he is. He's such a clown. I mean, to us, he has calmed down a little bit because of this, because of the lawsuit, and because of the all the investigations that have been happening with the Department of Justice. But, I mean, just not too long ago, like a couple of months ago, he would still, like, literally, like, get press releases out to the media to announce his race in, like, different places where we knew that the majority of people there are Hispanics or undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, I don't really know if that happens often in other states, but, I mean, to us, is now it's like it's something really normal, and it's just like, to me, it's not right, you know?
It's normal that there are raids, you're saying?
No, I mean, I don't know if it's normal that a sheriff actually chooses to put out press releases to...
Oh, I see.
Saying, you know, like he's going to go target a certain, you know, a certain community. And to me, that's more of a scare tactic than anything else. I mean, and it works. I mean, here in at least in Mesa, there was, like, around 2010, there was, like, a period of time where, like, every single week there was an announcement made in the radio. Like, even in the Spanish radio stations, that would say, you know, make sure you don't go out of your house, or make sure you don't drive today if you're undocumented because, you know, the sheriff announced a raid. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's basically a scare tactic to make sure that undocumented, you know, folks do feel the pressure of leaving and do this whole thing of, you know, attrition through enforcement that has been happening for such a long time. And so, you know, he has been doing it for a while.
Well, we have a new guest on the show has just called in. I believe this would be Dan and... Valeria, Dan DeVivo and Valeria Fernandez are the filmmakers behind the movie Two Americans. And one of the two Americans is none other than Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Am I right? Did I guess right? Is that you, Dan?
Yes, sir. This is Dan and Valeria Fernandez.
Hello. Thank you for having
us. Hello. Thanks for joining us. There's a number of people here who will probably want to ask you questions, but did you hear Erica describing the climate that she has been living in Mesa, Arizona, which is part of Maricopa County, as you know, under the reign of terror inflicted by Sheriff Joe Arpaio?
Yes.
You know, we're joining you right now from Nogales, Mexico, actually. And mm-hmm. It's, you know, one thing I think that a lot of us that being in Maricopa County for the last 10 years or so that we know is that this is not new. You know, bills, I guess, within 70 didn't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you have Sheriff Joe Arpaio since 2005, 2006, and then after he signed an agreement with the federal government, starting to conduct all of these sweeps that were really terrifying for the Latino community. And you can really thrive by using a lot of the state laws and working together with our state legislature and politicians like former Senator Russell Pierce, and also working with the county attorney that was recently disbarred, Andrew Thomas. So this is something that's been brewing for quite a long time in Arizona. And sometimes, I mean, I guess for us that live in Maricopa County, we want to get that point across. It just didn't happen overnight. And the exodus of people choosing to move and live in other states has been going on probably since 2007, since we passed that employee sanctions law that allowed the sheriff to conduct all of these terrifying raids at places of businesses. Businesses, which is what you see in the film, you know, one of the sweeps that he conducted resulting in the separation of an immigrant family. And, you know, the other character in the film, Catherine Figueroa, is a 9-year-old girl that suffered from that separation. But it's just an example of the many, many other families that have to go through this in Arizona for many years.
So tell us about your collaboration in making this film.
Oh, yeah, hey, so basically, I got interested in what was happening in Arizona back in 2004 when I was learning about how many people were dying on the border as a result of the funnel that happened, right? Because the U.S. border policy kind of attempted to shut down border crossings in San Diego and shut down border crossings in El Paso, Texas. And what happened was a lot of the traffic started coming through Arizona. They kind of knew that would happen, but what was interesting to me is that as that was happening, inside of Arizona, there were some kind of nasty responses, and people were being overwhelmed with the number of immigrants coming through. So I made this film back in 2004, 2006 called Crossing Arizona, kind of documenting the rising death toll along the border as a result of being funneled into the most dangerous part along the border, which is very hot. People can't survive without water, so they cross. And then basically the rising death toll and the rising tide of anti-immigrant sentiment. But, you know, in that film, I focused on, say, you know, the Minutemen, who were this group of people who would go out to the border and say, you know, we don't want Mexicans crossing our border illegally. But they were really a little bit wacky. Actually, a lot of people would say that the Minutemen Party is kind of a precursor to the Tea Party that we see here in the U.S. today. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the way that their opinions and their political alignments. But basically, they didn't really have officially sanctioned power. They were kind of people raising a whole lot of noise, like, you know, having public protests. But, you know, when I said, well, what's the next topic going to be with regard to this immigration issue and what's happening inside of Arizona, I started looking at Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was really, you know, an officially sanctioned, you know, sheriff, and he was cooperating with the federal government to work on ways to enforce federal immigration policies and laws at a local level. And this was something that was unique, and essentially he was a pioneer in the country towards, you know, arresting immigrants and pulling immigrants over and detaining immigrants. And so that's what happened there. I started looking into that because I wanted to show, well, what would happen if it wasn't the Minutemen, if it was somebody who had officially sanctioned power who could actually start targeting immigrants. And that's what we see here in Phoenix today. That's what, you know, we've been talking about. So I started looking into that, but I said, you know what, there's another whole side of the story. We can't just tell the story of, you know, the law enforcement aspect. It's also very important that we give our viewers a chance to understand what's going on inside the lives of these people who are being targeted, who are being pursued. And so I met Valeria, and Valeria is a journalist, and she's been working in the Spanish press for many years in Arizona, for 10 years, and now she's doing more than just Spanish press. But that's how I met her. She was out on the circuit, and she and I said, well, you know what, this is a great idea, and we, working together, you know, we can work on the sheriff's side of the story, and also we can work and try to find a story that would help, you know, Americans to understand, like, what's happening inside families, Latino families living in Phoenix, where they're facing just a constant targeting by the local mm-hmm. police department in Arizona.
Sheriff's Department, you mean?
In this case, it's the Sheriff's Department, yes. But when laws pass, like SB 1070, this is where we're going when laws like that pass. And so it's truly local law enforcement is the issue. And the sheriff is just a good example. The sheriff's office in Phoenix, Arizona is a good example of what happens when the federal government just allows local law enforcement entities to enforce immigration law. And when there's a breakdown in trust between what local police forces are supposed to do, which is to protect the community and keep the community safe, when they start targeting people to just try to, single them out for their immigration status, exactly. So that's what the sheriff is doing in Maricopa County.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So was that Erica saying something?
No, I was just agreeing with everything that they've been saying, especially the fact that this has been happening for such a long time. And just like how, this is brought up right now, like recently, but this has been for years. And I said, like in the last show, like even in my family was targeted back in 2010. We had a raid going to my house. And every single day, this has been happening like for so long. And I'm just really surprised that it's taking such a long time for the federal government to take, a stance on this. I don't know if it's for political reasons or not, but to be honest, like, we have to pressure both sides, not just making sure that we get rid of Sheriff Joe, but we also have to make sure that we get rid of things like secure communities and 27Gs that are really, really helping these people do this, all this work, all these raids, and giving them more tools to target communities of color here in Phoenix and in Mesa and all Maricopa County.
Well, we have Wasim still on the line. I wanted to see if you had a question for Dan and Val. I'm afraid I'm not going to pronounce your name right. I'm sorry.
Oh, Val. That was good. Val was good, right, Val?
You can call me Val.
Okay. Thank you, Val. Wasim, were you aware, first of all, of Sheriff Joe Arpaio before the SB 1070 soap opera began?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was asking Wasim. Wasim lives in Virginia. He's not Latino, and so he's very politically aware. So I was curious because I had heard, I was in Virginia at the time as well. I had heard of Sheriff Joe before SB 1070 was signed by Governor Brewer. So Wasim, how about you? Back in 07, 08, 09, did you know about?
I started to pick up on him in the 08 era when we traveled with the Obama campaign and found out when ended up there, found out the way he – stories I heard were horror stories about the way he treated our brothers there and his sisters. So remind me was what the definition of terrorism actually – it is not necessary just to stop a bomb and blow yourself up. To terrorize a family in their own safety home and to make them feel unsafe and comfortable, that's defined also as being terrorism too. And for somebody with authority and a gun to do that, is this outrageous, where they're supposed to be defending those people and protecting them from all the harms instead of them walking on them and hurt them. It's just devastating to me. I wish this could stop.
Erica, what was the fallout when you had your home raided? What happened then?
So basically, what happened is my mother and my stepfather were working at a water park here in Tempe. It's actually really close to Mesa. And they received, I believe, someone related or someone who was working in the park supposedly they called the sheriff, and they came to my mother's workplace, and they raided the place. Fortunately, my mom wasn't there at that time that the raid happened. So what they did is they took all of the documents that they had for the different individuals that were there, and they went to every single house of the workers. So what ended up happening is that my mom got a call from a coworker sending her that the sheriff was outside of her house and that they had just raided the park because he was on the news. And we found out a little bit later that the same coworker was deported, or not even deported, that was taken into custody. So, you know, of course, my family and I were really terrified. I was actually in school around that time. I was at ASU, and my mom called me to tell me that I had to get back home, like, ASAP. So we stayed inside of the house for about 2 to 3 days, like 2 days and a half without, like, no turning lights on. Like, we were inside the room, really quiet. My mom was, like, freaking out. She has, like, heart problems, like, not heart problems, but, like, pressure, high blood pressure. She was just, like, getting really sick at the same time. So it was a really horrible moment for our family. And we ended up having to sell our house that we had for a really long time. We ended up selling everything so that we could, you know, they lost their job, of course, so we had to, like, sell everything to be able to rent another apartment. So, I mean, ever since then, like, our lives have really, really changed, and that's basically one of the biggest motivators for me to, you know, be an activist and an immigrant rights organizer, because I went through all this, and I know that this is terrifying. I mean, for you know, children that have to go through this. At that time, I was already 21, you know, so I understood all of this, but my little brother was only around 11 years old, so he didn't understand what was going on. And yeah. To me, it's just not, you know, it's just not something that you do with families. And I understand they want to, you know, they want to make sure that the people are not working here or whatnot, but they don't realize the harm that they're doing to actual families and communities.
Well, something that you said just now made it clear to me that this kind of abuse of law enforcement in order to achieve a political goal has an economic consequence as well. And, of course, we all know the tragic economic consequences of SB 1070 in Arizona and of the law in Alabama and, of course, Prince William County, Virginia, and Hazleton, Pennsylvania, every place where essentially politics has polluted law enforcement. It's not just the targeted community that has paid, but it is the entire community, or in these cases now the entire state. But what you just said to me now, Erica, made me realize it also really interrupts and maybe even makes impossible the natural progression of an immigrant family to, you know, to be becoming homeowners and sending their kids to college and living the American dream. I mean, all of this has the impact of essentially undoing the American dream for certain targeted communities. And what you just said really hit home with me.
Yeah, I mean, trust me, it happens. Not only to families, but really small businesses also been targeted by him. And, I mean, not too long ago, we actually had one. He had a raid right in front of our home. It was a dry cleaner. It was a really, really small business that had probably, like, 2 undocumented people there. And he, for some reason, decided to have this raid in Mesa right in front of my apartment. And this really small business ended up closing. And just because of all of the negative, you know, it was all over the news, and it brought up a lot of negative attention to that business, and they decided to close. So, you know, it's hurting families, like I said, it's hurting communities, and it's hurting businesses in so many ways.
So Dan and Val, when you made this film, of course, you know, there is sort of a credo for documentarians and journalists that you have to try to be as, of course, accurate as possible and fair as possible, and really try to remove your own perspective from the storytelling. So I wonder if you could talk about some of the artistic, creative, and journalistic choices that you had to make in the course of putting this film together.
Well, I think that one of the important things when we were documenting the story of the immigrant family whose the parents were arrested at one of these raids in a car wash, was that we wanted them to be protagonists. We wanted them to tell their own story, really put them at the forefront. So something more than, it's a very traumatic experience. It was a horrific tragedy for this family. They were really able to overcome that. And I think we wanted to show the complexity that, you know, these are people, yes, they were victims in a way, but they were also took charge of their own situation, and they really were able to overcome it. And I think it was important to convey that, and to convey that, you know, they had dreams for their children, and that there's a lot in common with this immigrant family, with any other average immigrant family. And I think that that was that perspective. And I mean, as far as Sheriff Joe Arpaio, there's so much in the media about him. He's the subject of so many different investigations, criminal, civil, you know, issues of misspending. But I think Dan did a tremendous job of getting access to him and getting him to go off book and really, you know, show a glimpse of what goes on in the mind of this politician that has really capitalized on the fears of people about immigration to boost his career. And I think that the sheriff speaks for himself in the film. We didn't like try to portray him on a good or a bad light. I think he speaks for himself. And I mean, I don't know if you want to add more to this, Dan, but people will be able to come up to their own conclusions about why he does the things that he does and what motivates him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, the what did you call it, like, you know, a expectation that documentary and filmmakers should be somehow fair and balanced. But I think that's a bit of a, you know, over-assertion. I know it's traditionally what you hear, but I don't think, you know, I got involved in it because, you know, I felt that what it was politically motivated with, you know, the sheriff was not always going after the immigrant community. So I was like, you know, what, that was interesting to me. You know, what made him change his approach? What made him start going after immigrants? So I was just interested in that. And also, you know, on a certain level, I identified with him a little bit because he reminded me a little bit of my grandfather. So this is the thing. What I'm saying is that I think sometimes as artists and documentary filmmakers or filmmakers, whatever, I think we get involved in our stories for personal reasons. And in this case, like, I had a grandfather who was a terribly racist man, and he disowned his daughter marrying a black man. And, you know, I had, you know, conversations with him to try to convert him or try to get him to change his mind. So in a way, when I found out about the sheriff who was also had a similar ancestry, and when I had got the chance to meet him and shake his hand, somehow I was reminded of my grandfather. And I said, you know, maybe I can, like, talk to him and get him to really explain to me why it's so important that he is, you know, doing these things, creating hardships in other people's lives. Because I didn't, for me, that's where I come from, in terms of politically and morally and humanistically. I'm really against the, you know, targeting people and making their lives more difficult, this prejudice, this racism that, you know, is happening in Arizona, this anti-immigrant sentiment that's happening in Arizona, I'm really against it. So I just think that for me it was actually a personal interest, and the way that I would approach it with the sheriff was just a less confrontational approach than one might expect. I just gave him the chance to air his feelings and hung out with him as much as possible. And in fact, it was very hard to be a fly on the wall with Sheriff Joe Arpaio because he's so used to, you know, speaking to the cameras, to getting his message out there. You know, there was the question of whether why he would allow us to do this, you know, but he's always kind of benefited from other people putting forth his image as being a tough guy, you know, so there wasn't really a conflict there. He kind of knew that we would be just letting, you know, I don't know. He just didn't really have a lot of fears about being portrayed as a tough guy. He just wanted to know that the film would actually get made. So I just kind of talked to him in a very non-confrontational way. Sorry for being so long-winded.
No worries. And I imagine
judgmental, at least in the way that you comported yourself, but do you judge him in your heart?
Well, I think that, I mean, for so many years, being a reporter there in Arizona and seeing what's been going on, that people are getting deported from hospitals when they're in a coma and their family's struggling, and you know, covering that raid at the water parks and going there into the neighborhood and hearing the fear from the people when the sheriff's deputy showed in that community, hearing from pregnant women that were shackled while giving birth in a prior jail, hearing about some of the mistreatment that goes in there. It's really impossible to be completely impartial about this. Sometimes you have to call things for what they are. And I mean, I feel sometimes the role you have as a journalist and a filmmaker is to try to shed light on those things. And I think that's what motivated me. I wanted most of the people in Maricopa County to awake to what's going on. And oftentimes, you know, on TV, it's very limited. You get to hear just a tiny little bit. There was another drop house with, you know, there were weapons in the house. There were immigrants there. They were kidnapped. There was another shooting. And you really don't get to know really who are the people. Who are the people that are living in your communities? Who are these immigrants? They're your next door neighbors. So I, in that sense, I think I'm a little impartial. Because of the accumulation of so many things that to me feel like injustices that shouldn't go on.
And at the same time, on the humanity of the sheriff, and what's interesting also to us, and what a lot of people don't know about the sheriff is that he's a first, is it first or second generation? Point is, his parents were immigrants from Italy. I mean, so when you start thinking about this, okay, his parents were immigrants from Italy. He will say, yeah, they came legally, and now that he's on this anti-immigrant kick. But he grew up in a broken home. His mother died at childbirth. He had a hard knock life. He was a cop, and, you know, for many years. Then he went to be with the DEA, and he learned how to be an undercover agent. So he's really a product of his environment. Right now, it's not a surprise that he's one of the most powerful and influential and notorious politicians in the U.S., because what makes politicians popular in the U.S.? Well, you know, they're characters. They have charisma. They're tough on crime. Sometimes, you know, some might say, well, you know, they know, you know, how to deal with money. And I mean, I don't know. But the point is that at the end of the day, you know, it's a terrible situation that politics in America has come to something that's. Is the electoral system and the way that politicians are able to use the media echo chamber to play on the fears of the majority of the voting public. So it's terrible, but it's also quite predictable and interesting to think about how somebody who's putting so much pressure on the Latino community in Phoenix, and in the instance of our film, Two Americans, where he tore apart the home of this young girl, Catherine Figueroa, you know, it's something that he went through. So it's really kind of sad to see, to really kind of understand how history is getting repeated. In his case, you know, he had a hard knock life, and now he's kind of, because of his own interest in getting maintaining popularity, he's willing to subject somebody else to that experience, and he hasn't learned from his childhood. And I don't know, it's just something interesting that we've been batting around and thinking about throughout the entire process of making this film.
Yeah.
Not to judge him, but to try to just understand what, you know, and why he's making the decisions that he's making.
You know how when you send an email in which 10 or 20 people are copied, and then there's a misunderstanding, and then suddenly there's two people kind of jousting. And it goes on and on and on until you have to beg them to stop copying you on the emails. But the truth is, the reason why they are continuing to fight is because you're copied on that email. If it was just between them, they wouldn't be doing this performance for you. But each of them felt slighted, and so it just goes around and around and around. in some ways, I think what happens with politicians is it's that, you know, on a much larger scale, once they become public figures and they have a measure of pride and they have the fear of humiliation, the fear of electoral defeat, the fear of legislative defeat, the fear of a legal defeat, and there's criticism, very harsh criticism coming from the media, coming from the county board of supervisors, coming from the business community, and of course the Latino community, it just becomes this cycle where you sort of, your pride gets caught up in the fight. And, you know, I saw it happen to some of the main characters in the film that I did in Virginia, where these are people who were, you know, just a few years earlier, regular good people, you know, conservative, but not the brand of conservative that we now find to be so alienating and confusing. But what happens is, I think the public eye tends to warp people, and so suddenly it's not about how it affects this young girl's life. It's about how does it help me beat those people who are trying to beat me down. You know, it's about that contest. And I think that happens to way too many politicians, and it's a shame that it does. And I don't know if there's an antidote to it other than that we need people with stronger character to run for public office. Let me see if...
Yeah, very interesting.
We have Andres in Houston and Jose in Chicago. I'm going to open up both of their mics and see if either one of them have a comment or a question. We haven't heard from them in a while.
Okay, so I guess I'll go first. Well, I wanted to commend them for their work. It sounds very interesting. As a filmmaker, I think that it's very important for me to hear that honesty, you know, and I know many filmmakers try to be impartial, but it's also more honest for me when they do display their emotions, you know, or just let a character reveal itself. And for me, it's very interesting because to me, Arpaio, Sheriff Arpaio and Jan Brewer, these guys seem so easy to vilify. It's like they're ready-made movie villains. You know, to me, it's like there's nothing, you know, it seems like it would be so hard to see the other side. So it makes me really curious to know where are they coming from? Are they really, is it in their hearts to victimize people who are trying to make a better life, who are, you know, who are just doing the work that many people don't want to do, who are contributing to the economy, or kids like Erica, you know, who just want to come out into the light, you know, they want to be legal, they want to pay taxes, go to school, everything that we admire, you know, everything that's supposed to be what this country is about. Are they really against that? It seems so hard to understand, but it's important, I think, to try to make the effort to understand as much as we can from them, because as Eric has said, because he has his father, you know, and his positions in some ways are different than his own. Sometimes, like in the case of Arpaio, who reminds you of grandfather, sometimes these are the people we live next to, just like we are the people they live next to. So sometimes it takes reaching across someone that's actually physically closer to you to try to find a platform onto which to discuss these things and find what it is. And I feel very confident that we are actually advocating for equality and for such important values that it's an attempt worth having. And I think films like these and films like the one Eric made are great examples of this, of trying to reach out and or trying to understand what happens and what happens to communities and where the other side is coming from. Hello?
Yeah, certainly. I think that he's making an excellent point. And, you know, we often ask ourselves, is Sheriff Joe Arpaio making history, or he is a product of these times? And I feel he's more of a product of these times. And if he wasn't in that spot, somebody else would have been. And, you know, it helps us also to understand him. It kind of helps us understand what ticks the people that are following him. And I think that those are the people that we want to have a conversation with. You know, the people that are somewhat like-minded to the sheriff or believe that what he's doing is right or support him. And, you know, it casts a light on why he has such a huge following.
Okay, Jose, here's a quiz for you. What do you say to those people? How do you get through to somebody who has been exposed to the same kind of rhetoric that inspired Joe Arpaio's television career and transformed his political career? What's your pitch to get them to try to focus on other priorities than racial anxiety?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. But I think, you know, just humanizing it. And, you know, there's a lot of effort in pitching, you know, stop the deportations, because this 7-year-old is going to be going home and he's never seen Mexico before. And I think that really helps really humanize, look, this could be you if you were struggling in the United States and you had to make an emergency trip to Canada or to any other part of the world. I think humanizing it and saying, look, you know, these people don't want to come here illegally and they don't want to break the laws and they want to do everything that's right in their power for their own family, but there has to be an easier way and we're making it very difficult for these people to survive and provide for the family. So humanizing it and just saying, look, what would you do if you were in their shoes? Would you really sacrifice your whole family's well-being just to stay in the same position and not pursue a better, you know, economic pursuit? You know, I think anyone in those shoes would definitely, you know, do anything to leave and provide better economic opportunities and stuff. But I also had like another question for the filmmakers, and I know that you mentioned the Minutemen and how that kind of inspired you to figure out like, well, what's Joe Arpaio's take on the whole situation? Do you find that he like was more inspired by the Minutemen, or is that how he kind of got into kind of advocating against immigration, or did he just? I mean, I was just kind of trying to figure out where.
No, totally. I mean, the way I understand your question, I'll try to answer it. So, I mean, basically, we feel that the Minutemen, when they went down and they got the attention that they did by Fox News Media and, you know, whoever else was giving them all the attention in the world, they gained an enormous amount of popularity. So what happened in Arizona is politicians kind of caught on to that and said, how can I get a piece of that? We can just say that through anecdotal evidence, but in Phoenix, in the case of Joe Arpaio, there is one incident that you can talk about that really was the turning point for him. Okay, so what happened for Joe Arpaio was back in 2005, there was a gentleman who was like a retired, I don't know, Army reservist, and perhaps even a veteran, I'm not sure, but he thought he could make a citizen's arrest at a highway rest stop, and he held people who he thought were Mexicans at gunpoint, and basically waited until the police got there. But the sheriff showed up on the scene, right?
Yeah, what actually happened, I'll complete this little bit, is that the sheriff deputy showed up and he says, listen, the one that committed the crime, it was you by holding these people at gunpoint. And so eventually the county attorney, Andrew Thomas, who ran on the platform of fighting illegal immigration, said, we're not going to press charges against this man. He did the right thing. They were committing a crime and they were supposed to be arrested. And Thomas got tremendous popularity because of that, and the sheriff got a lot of heavy criticism for arresting, you know, this hero that had captured this undocumented immigrant.
Hero, quote-unquote.
Yeah, quote-unquote. And so I think at that time, that made a little click on the sheriff's brain. Wait a second. Andrew Thomas is getting more attention than I've been getting. And I've been famous on my pink underwear and my 10th city. It might be time for me to sort of update my tactic here. Illegal immigration seems to be something that is resonating in Arizona. It certainly resonated with voters that passed several anti-immigrant laws at that time. And the Minutemen that drew so much attention. And so there was this really weird turn of events in which actually Arpaio ended up teaming up with Andrew Thomas to start charging undocumented immigrants to conspire into their own smuggling. And so it was the beginning of Arpaio taking on the issue of illegal immigration and creating this persona, this national persona. But then I didn't mean to.
No. That's fine. Yeah, that was like a turning point. And so this is a guy who acted in a very vigilante way, which originally the sheriff was saying, no, you can't do that. I'm the one who points the guns around here. And then another politician got, yeah, exactly. And then another politician got famous off of taking the opposite perspective and going against the people who were perceived to be there illegally. And so the sheriff kind of took a note out of his book.
And one more thing, what's interesting is that after the sheriff took that stance, then you started seeing a bunch of other politicians running for office on the platform of I will deny electricity access to undocumented immigrants. I mean, the craziest of, like, seriously, if this happened, the craziest of ideas, everybody had a plan to deal with illegal immigration, even if it wasn't. And then the best example is Governor Jim Brewer. You know, she took all the credit for SB 1070, but the reality is that all these other politicians were building the stage for her to do that.
Well, yeah, she needed an issue to win the primary. She probably could not have won the primary to be elected governor without getting behind SB 1070. But the interesting thing is that I always compare politics to professional wrestling, and I'm sorry I have to do it again. But the thing about Arpaio deciding to suddenly try to out anti-immigrant the county attorney, it reminds me of this professional wrestler named Adrian Adonis from the 80s. His tag team partner later became the governor of Minnesota. His name was Jesse the Body Ventura. And when Jesse retired from wrestling, Adrian Adonis didn't really have a shtick, because his shtick was, I'm the East-West connection. I'm from New York. Jesse's from Los Angeles. Actually, Venice Beach or something, or Ventura. He was from Ventura or something like that. So he went away for a month, and then he came back in pink and purple tights, and he ran around with these scarves, and he said that he'd woken up one morning and he was now gay. And he got really great results for that, because suddenly the audience, you know, the arena hated him. I mean, they hated him before, but now they really hated him. They hated him with glee. And he would kiss his opponent during the match. You know, he'd pound the guy's head into the turnbuckle 15 times, and he'd be a little woozy. And then he'd kiss him on the cheek, and the guy would act like, you know, he just had acid thrown on his face, and he'd writhe in pain. But anyway, it's just so theatrical what happened. And I want to bring Wasim back in, because, you know, he and I were talking about the anti-Muslim and anti-Arab hysteria that was being exploited for political gain in the first half of the 2000s, you know, of the aughts. And, you know, I think that a lot of what happened, a lot of why we have an anti-immigrant, you know, problem right now in America is because of the shock of September 11th, the reservoir of fear that politicians could tap into to not necessarily marshal a majority, but a vocal, radical minority, very easily manipulated. And also because they were so ferocious, and because the accusations were so hateful to anyone who would stand in their way, what it did is it suppressed dissent, it even suppressed participation. In other words, the first 5 or 6 years of that decade proved the power of fear politics. And even though that particular target was no longer bearing fruit because we were tiring of the war on terror and the war in Iraq and the little DEFCON rainbow things going up and down. They knew that there was power in fear politics. They were addicted to the high of fear politics. And so they simply turned the turret. They shifted focus to Latinos. And Wasim, I asked you this before, but more pointedly, did you see that? Did you feel the target shift away from you during that time, or am I just kind of overstating it here?
The Latino community is a wider community, and it's an easier target to because they really don't fight back. They're very kind, and they just sit back and take it. And then they found an easy target, a lot easier than the Arab and Muslims, because we fought back big time. And we made a lot of noise, and we made it very hard for them to keep bad-mouthing us. That's something that is we never going to back off anyway, because they are wrong and we're right, exactly like as our Latino community are right, and they should stand for that. And this, yes, did shift big time, but during the election 2008 came back and hit us very, very hard with Park 51. This is the center they were trying to open for education in New York, and it become a national issue for the Muslim community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And have not stopped. The last 2 years, they were 35 states who introduced anti-Islamic laws in their state.
The Sharia law. They're afraid that a country that has less than 2% Muslim and is a democracy is going to vote for Sharia law. That's their fear.
Yes. And it's so sad. It's just, you know, they care on ignorant. I mean, the people who you have to end up dealing with is the ignorant people who have no idea what they're doing. I mean, they go and grab a Sikh and they hurt them, and then that is, you're Muslim and go back home. That's how ignorant they are. And, you know, so sad. And we all live in it, so.
Well, we only have about 4 minutes left, so I'm going to ask Dan and Val to try to answer the question that I asked Jose, and I've asked pretty much throughout this call. What do we say to the professional wrestling fans out there? What do we say to the people who cheer or boo on command when somebody brings up an issue like this? Whether it's, you know, we didn't even mention what the historic events of this week with the president coming out for gay marriage, but whatever the target is, there's a certain class of people that are just going to hoot and holler, and then that's going to encourage the politicians, and then we just go into this vicious cycle. Do we just not waste any time talking to them? Do we try to reach out to them? Or should we maybe be reaching out to the moderate silent majority instead? What do you guys think?
I think we should be reaching to the moderate silent majority and talk to that group of people, because there are some people that are in the role of just, you know, making noise and confusing the conversation. And I think you just need to open up new spaces such as this one to have this type of conversations and make a noise of a different kind. I mean, not noise, but that get rid of the noise and bring clarity and open a space for talking to those that, you know, this is an issue that they don't necessarily care about, but you have to find a way to make them realize that it matters to them too, because there's so much more that in the issue of immigration that the average American has in common with the average immigrant family. And I think in finding that common ground, if we can highlight that and start thinking about immigrants as I was hearing this concept that some people are talking about as new Americans, as people that are aspiring to this dream, rather than illegal aliens and invaders, you know, we can change the conversation. But maybe I am being too naive with that. But I think it starts even from the people we have around. You know, we all have somebody that is like Dan's grandfather as close to our you know, circle. And it starts on the ground. It starts in the community and the neighborhoods. And by not getting too defensive about your point of view, but trying to listen to the other side and get beyond the noise. But it's tough. So, Dan, I don't know what you want to add.
No, I mean, I think that was said beautifully, beautifully, beautifully. I completely agree. And, you know, just to, you know, why do we make this film? Because we feel that it might catch the gaps. It had, you know, it has the opposing viewpoints with Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the experience of the family whom he targeted. So it's like, you know, you try to show Joe for what he is and how he projects himself, and you try to capture this family and how they represent themselves, and you try to let people just kind of make their own decision. And I think there's very little illusion when you're a filmmaker about, you know, convincing a hardcore conservative, you know, to change their views just from watching your film. I don't think it's going to happen. But the point is there are people out there who are silent and don't know enough about the issues. And so, you know, using art like this is one way to perhaps, you know, activate that group of people to see the missteps in going the way towards fear and ignorance, and hopefully they'll get more involved in voting for people and getting involved in their community in a way that they can make a positive impact.
And I mean, I know we're probably running out of time, but it's also casting a light. It's casting a light on Jared Orbite. I mean, I really like what Dan was saying earlier. I mean, he's also a human being, and he's had a difficult childhood, and it's understanding as well where he's coming from, and that he's a product of these times, and it could have been anybody else in that position, but it's the game of the politics that's at play. And with the immigrant family, it's getting closer. I mean, oftentimes people are like, "Oh, we got to get rid of the illegals." But then they tell you, "Oh, but the guy that's cutting, trimming my trees, oh, he's such a nice guy. He can't be illegal." So it's when you're face-to-face to the actual people, when you individualize it and you give it a face, like, you know, the dreamers are doing, putting their stories out there.
Yeah.
It's beginning.
Yeah, Erica, you're a dreamer in residence, and, you know, you guys have done so much by showing the courage to say, "I am undocumented, I am unafraid." I think that,
mm-hmm.
that courage is spreading right now all around the country, and not just on this issue, but on other issues. I think that you inspired the courage that the president showed this week. I really do think that, you know, at the height of these intimidation tactics that are being used by the extreme right, to have the most vulnerable community and with the most to lose, because you all have such bright futures, to have you stand up and say, "I'm going to fight for the rights of my family, of my community, and the future of my country, and I don't care what name you call me, and I don't care what you try to do to me, I'm gonna stand up." And I just really commend you and all the dreamers for doing that.
No, thank you. Yeah, and we have to keep doing that. We have to. One of the comments that was made earlier is that, you know, how do we make this more of a human issue? And I think that's what we've been trying to do as undocumented youth, you know, make this a human issue. And I mean, myself, I had a conversation once with peers, with, you know, the author of Z1070, and out of that conversation, like, you know, came out like, really, you know, I'm a human being, I am undocumented, and this is who you're trying to, you know, target. Like, what do you say to me? And on camera, of course, it's politics. They have to do this. You know, they have to come out against me. He called me all kinds of names. Yet, you know, we were able to speak to him behind cameras at the end of the event where we were, and he had a whole different attitude towards us. And so it's, you know, it's really understanding that we have to do this, like undocumented youth, and we're trying to also get our parents to not be afraid, and to also, you know, share their stories and share what it is that immigrants and undocumented immigrants bring to the country, that's unnecessarily, you know, crime and whatnot.
Okay, well, we're basically in overtime right now, so our online listeners can't hear us anymore. But the people who listen to us on archives, well, they'll still hear this part. So everybody's mic is open right now except for a caller from 303. And just to just out of curiosity, I'm going to open this mic 303 area code, which I think is Denver, where I am right now. Did
Hello?
You have a comment?
Yeah, I am from Denver, and thanks for taking my call. I was listening to your show, and I agree with most of what you said, and I was at one point one of those people who was one of the neocons on the right, and I hated illegal immigrants, and it was a huge issue for me, and I think I get more angry about the issue today than I did then, because I realized I was manipulated, and it really pisses me off, and I guess I see things from a different perspective. Like, when I, you know, I completely agree that it's just this political issue, but I see it as a bigger issue because, like, I don't believe the government owns this country, you know. I don't think that the politicians own anything. So for them to say that somebody can or can't come, you know, I think is ridiculous. And if people want to talk entitlements or something like that, they should talk about that. But telling people where they can and can't go, I think is ridiculous, and I think it's beyond their authority. And when it comes to, like, Arpaio, I see this as, like, another political game. This guy has been violating people's rights, prisoners and people for so many years. And then when he started taking shots at Obama, then all of a sudden, you know, the feds come down on him. So, you know, I see that as, like, another aspect of the pro wrestling, because they let him get away with crazy stuff forever. And then all of a sudden, when he gets more political, then they target him. So I'm not saying he shouldn't be targeted, but I'm just saying that they're not doing it out of, you know, trying to be the good guys. They're the bad guys too, you know, and they're playing the same game. And, you know, Obama comes out for gay marriage in 1997. Then when he's president, Obama, he's running for president, he's for, you know, heterosexual couples, you know, and he's not for, you know, same-sex marriages. And then all of a sudden, recently comes out and his numbers are down for gay marriage again. So I don't really look at that as courage either. I don't think any of these politicians have any courage.
Well, I just, what's your name in Denver?
Mr. Politics.
Okay, Mr. Politics. Okay. First of all, I think that maybe Dan and Val can help you with some chronology. As it happens, there was a long-term investigation of Sheriff Arpaio and the way that he was operating his sheriff's department. I'm not sure if – I think you're talking about the press conference that he held. He sort of pulled a Donald Trump, and he held a press conference saying he was going to prove that President Obama was not a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, he took other shots, too, at the administration. And I'm not saying that, like, his shots are accurate or anything like that. I'm just saying that, like, if you look at his abuse of people in the penal system – and his abuse of illegals even before this. I mean, this has been going on a really, really long time. This is what this guy's known for, you know. He's known for the pink underwear and all this other nonsense and, you know, feeding his prisoners, you know, practically dog food. The guy has just been out of control for a long time. I mean, he's been out of control for, you know, well over a decade. I remember watching a documentary about him, and it must have been like, you know, 12, 15 years ago. So I don't know how long term of an investigation they've been running, but if they've been doing it over a decade, then that's a bit too long. I think that having one prisoner's rights violated by this guy is enough to warrant an investigation, much less, you know, countless thousands of people that he's violated the constitutional rights.
I wanted to say something to Mr. Politics. I think you are on the point. I mean, we have this conversation for quite a while, ever since we started the film. I mean, Sheriff Arpaio has been in power for 20 years. This is the sixth term that he's running. The DOJ conducted an investigation on him back in 1997 because they were using restraint chairs on the prisoners. There were several deaths there that he promoted the guards that were involved on this death. There were over $40 million, probably more than $40 million paid for these lawsuits. So there's been a lot of stuff going on with the agency for several years. I mean, back then, Amnesty International compared what was going on in the jails to torture. So it's interesting that we're fast forward in 2012 and you
it's
know,
an election year and he's in the media,
yeah, no,
you know.
Yeah. I know, but, I mean, we're still in 2012, and we're seeing a repeat. I mean, recently, I think it was the end of last year, or that there was a prisoner, a Latino prisoner, that was killed. And there's a lot of questions about that, and it keeps coming every day. So I'm not saying that
he punishes prisoners for speaking Spanish. You know, like, it's any of his business, like, what language they speak, you know. And what really makes me angry about him is that the Tea Party embraces this guy, and this guy is, like, the ultimate example of tyranny, you know. I mean, like, I think our government's tyrannical every single day, but this guy, I mean, there's no arguing that this isn't tyranny, you know. And yet he's, like, become this symbol of this, like, Tea Party movement, and even in some ways the Patriot movement, and he's, like, the opposite of freedom. You know,
yeah.
So I think that people need to put themselves in check and actually look at things objectively and not look at it from, like, a left-right perspective, but just look at it as, like, you know, I mean, even, like, you know, the immigration laws they passed in Arizona, some of the people that were very supportive of those, again, were, like, Tea Party people that, like, supposedly claim they don't like the government and want more freedom. But what do you think is going to happen to even non-immigrants or even non-Hispanics? The cops are going to use these laws to mess with people they just don't like, you know. And it doesn't matter what skin color you're. At first, it's going to be like Hispanics and stuff, but they're going to use it to target anybody they feel like targeting, you know. And it gives them all this extra reach, you know. So I think people in that movement have to really be more objective. I think people on the left have to be suspicious too, because I don't think any of these politicians, you know, or who they say they are, I don't think that they have any respect for the American people or for people coming in from other countries.
All the mics are open, by the way, so if anybody has a question or comment, just pipe up. But I just wanted to ask real quickly, Mr. Politics, how long ago was it that you found the anti-immigrant rhetoric convincing?
Oh, I would say probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I think, you know, and what really made me kind of change my mind was I became a libertarian at one point. When I became a libertarian, I was like, look, like, government doesn't have the authority to tell people what to do or, like, you know, enforce borders when they don't own the country, you know. And for them to enforce borders is an implication that they own something. And they don't own anything. I mean, the people that own private property own stuff. But the private property is not part of the border in this imaginal, you know, this imaginary geographical border. So, like, I don't, I think that's what really changed my mind. And then later, I owned a liquor store in a pretty rough neighborhood. It wasn't really rough. I guess it was just, you know, impoverished. And I had a lot of Hispanic customers coming in, and they were my best customers and really good people. And I guess I just hadn't had exposure previously. And I realized that I was just totally being used. And it was, and the bigger thing too is that, you know, the government runs the economy into the ground repeatedly every other decade, you know, and they always have to pick some group as like a scapegoat, like as if like illegal immigrants are doing this to the economy, you know, as if like that impact is causing this devastation. And it's because the politicians like can't own up that they're destroying the economy.
Yeah. There was actually an anti-immigrant wave during the 20s when things were going wrong with our economy as well.
There's one in the 70s as well, you know, and it's always, like, spurred up this way. And it's just like, you know, the Muslims, you know, they were targeted too. And that was, you know, people thought that they were oppressing, like, some group that they disliked. But the Patriot Act and stuff, that oppressed all of us, you know. Mm-hmm. So when you start to really hate people for irrational or even rational reasons. I don't think any of these things are rational. But, you know, when you start to hate others like this, you end up, like, taking a bullet yourself, like, to try and punish them, because these laws end up giving the government more power, and the government abuses all of us.
That's awesome.
Well, I want to give everybody opportunity to say goodbye, because it has been more than 2 hours for some of us.
Okay,
but
I wanted to say something. To Mr. Potter,
yes.
I think.
Okay,
anybody,
you're all welcome to stay on. I'll stay on too.
Okay, I'm just going to say this one last thing. Even though I would probably disagree with him about the role of government, because I believe if government is representative, we do need an organization to protect us, which is us protecting ourselves and creating roads, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think he gives us an insight into something that is key to the argument today, which is what you were asking, Eric, about about how do we present this to those who based out of fear, or those manipulated by bigotry, or by those who use bigotry for economic means. How do we present our case? And I think it's very useful to think of it this way, the way he presented it. You know, it's like people who are advocating for freedom from government. Okay, well, how do you feel about this guy going and judging people by the color of their skin and asking for documents? And how do you feel? And the same thing goes for gay marriage. How do you feel about government, you know, dictating what happens in the bedroom? It's just not. It goes completely against.
Yeah, I see that. I see that issue from the same perspective too, because I see that issue is like, you know, I don't think that they should have authority over marriage. Period. So for them to tell like people, or people have to wait for consent from the president, you know, to do certain things, I think it's ridiculous. I think that people, you know, for free, I think people should be able to do as they please and marry whoever they want to marry.
Exactly.
You know?
So if I may finish, so exactly that I think that argument is one way to go into the conversation, and then we can stand on the other moral grounds about the dignity of every human being and everything else. But I think he offers us a way in that's very valid and very useful to us. And that's me signing out.
Okay. Thank you,
Andres.
All right.
Well, may I say a couple of things just before I sign out myself? But this is Wasim
again.
Okay,
this is Wasim. Yes, go ahead, Wasim.
Yes. The notion that is we actually justify or even allow ourselves to accept what the sheriff have done just because of his past is very, very wrong. I hate to disappoint anyone who will even allow that to be hit in their head. You know, it's like it's almost like the abuse become abuser. It's unacceptable in our society. We are in 21st century where people grow and evolve to better people. So we have to draw it out of our mind. But in the end of the day, it's a growing pain that all of us is going through, and this might be a journey for a very long time, as I said. And as long we engage, as long we communicate with the good and bad and the ugly, don't stop at anyone. All of them. Cover the whole spectrum. I think we will succeed, and we will be a better nation in the end of the day. And closing my talk in here, I would like to wish all the moms out there happy Mother's Day for this weekend. And thank you for raising our children and doing a great job for them. You know, hopefully they will be our future, you know. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, everyone, being on the show.
Thank you, Wasim. Anybody else want to make a closing comment?
I just wanted to say thank you for allowing me on.
Okay, well, come back again. We have Coffee Party radio shows every Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Thursday, and we're going to be adding a few to that. And so, and I see your number there. I might text you because I'm here in Denver. would that be okay?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Would it be okay if I texted you and it, like, invited you to
absolutely.
Event? Okay, cool. All right, cool. Dan and Val, did you just want to say anything in closing?
Well, I just want to say thanks a lot for providing this space. I think it's always great to talk to you, Eric, and it was really enjoyable hearing everybody's perspectives today. You know, two Americans, we're just starting to show the film, and people can, you know, tune into the website, twoamericans.com, and find a way to figure out where they can get their hands on that film.
Okay, no, that's two Americans, T-W-O.
Yes. And Valeria?
Yes, www.twoamericans.com. I just want to thank you very much. I really enjoy talking to everybody in the show. And, you know, we need to think more about that question. How do we get to that silent majority out there? And how do we find common ground? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jose, did you want to say anything in closing?
I agree. It was really a great pleasure talking to all of you guys. And honestly, I'm learning a lot from all of you guys because it's just a wealth of information. And I have like a whole list of things I'm going to read and watch tonight and over the next couple of weeks. So looking forward to spreading the word too. So thanks for joining me.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. I think that the one thing that above all else that I'm going to start working on that I learned from this call is Jose saying that we now have net zero immigration, and that is scary considering how many baby boomers there are going into retirement over the next 10 years, that we're going to have a ratio of people on retirement programs like Social Security and Medicare getting larger and larger compared to how many workers we have. Immigration is the only thing that's going to save us from a fiscal ticking time bomb. And we need to get our brand back as the nation of immigrants. And it's going to take all of our films, all of our songs, all of our radio shows, our blogging, our writing, and just communicating. It's going to take all of us to do that before it's too late. So let's get to work. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yeah.